Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. So keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left. Speaking today with Eric Ollenreich. He's a professor of sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and he's one of the leading theorists of class analysis. He's the author of Class, Crisis, and State, Class Structure and Income Determination, Classes, Class Counts, Approaches to Class Analysis, and also in 2003, Deepening Democracy, Institutional Innovations in Empowered Participatory Governance. Welcome, Eric Ollenreich.
Hello.
Back when I was an undergraduate, one of the pressing questions in class analysis was the question of whether we had new classes. And I know that you've written a lot about that, the way that the changing economy has created new classes. So first, tell us a little bit about why you chose to address class analysis in your work. And then let's get into a topic of has class structure actually changed, or is it the same that we've been talking about for the last 100 years?
Okay, so first of all, why bother with class? Class is a particular way of thinking about inequality. So I think everyone recognizes that inequality is an important problem. It's an important issue that we have rich and poor, for example, in a country like the United States. But inequality, that is simply looking at how much money people have, doesn't really tell you much about how people relate to each other, how they are interconnected. What class does is provide us with a way of trying to understand how the inequalities we observe are rooted in social relationships between people rather than simply differences in some quantity. So, for example, in American society, we don't simply have rich people and poor people. We have people who have great wealth, and by virtue of that wealth are in positions of power with respect to the organizations of employment in which poor people attempt to find work. So that creates a relationship between the rich and the poor, or capitalists and workers, if you will, rather than simply an inequality between them. And that's the reason for using a language of class rather than just a language of inequality to understand these things. Once you begin to think of inequality as being rooted in social groups and social categories rather than just differences in how much people earn, then you begin to realize that these defined ways of life, whole structures of opportunity and constraint rather than simply levels of consumption.
Now, your work is consciously and explicitly based in the Marxist tradition, and Marxism had a much more vital centrality to sociological analysis back in the 70s and 80s, and it seemed perhaps we've been incorporated into the sociological body of thinking. Do you think that that sociology is now post-Marxist? Is it incorporated Marxism, or is there still a vital need for an explicitly Marxist voice within social analysis?
Well, I certainly think there's a need for a Marxist voice, just like I also believe there's a need for a feminist voice in sociology. Marx, as a particular historical thinker, is widely recognized, even by sociologists who aren't particularly sympathetic to the Marxist tradition. Marx is recognized as one of the great figures in the development of sociology. So there is a strand of sociological thinking that stretches back to Marx, which has distinctive properties, asks distinctive questions, has distinctive preoccupations. And I think that remains an important voice within the discipline. It is true that many of these ideas have simply become incorporated into sociological thinking or into intellectual thinking more broadly. The idea of globalization, for example, which is a perfectly widespread concept these days, is actually something which has a very deep resonance with the Marxist tradition. Marxists have for decades been talking about the global reach of capitalism and the way in which this restructures the world. But this has only become a general idea within mainstream social science in the last 15 or 20 years. I mean, I like to think of Marxism as a tradition of debate rather than a doctrine. I distinguish the Marxist tradition from Marxology, the study of Marx, or Marxolatry, the praise of Marx. The Marxist tradition is a terrain of debate and discussion, which is defined more by a kind of moral, political set of issues and a menu of concepts and ideas than it is by a well-defined, well-bounded doctrine. Thus, there are, of course, endless debates within that tradition, and as a result, many people who don't define themselves as part of that tradition nevertheless participate in some of these debates and share many of the particular points of view.
One of the questions, as I said, that was of great interest to me when I was studying your work back in the day, and I'm glad to be reacquainted with your more recent work, was the question of the new class, the professional managerial class, and the notion of that there are different kinds of property that new classes might be based on. And it seemed to be an answer to this this charge against Marxism that Marx had not anticipated the changes in the economy and the fact that there wouldn't be an immiseration of the great mass of the proletarians. Is the professional managerial class still a concept that you are using in your work, or the notion of a class whose principal ownership is over its own knowledge?
Well, I never particularly cottoned up to the expression the professional managerial class. It struck me as mainly a descriptive category rather than one that was rooted in a general conceptual framework or theory about how to think about class positions, class structure, and the like. Nevertheless, I do recognize that the class structure of contemporary United States is much more complicated than the simple polarized two-class vision that one sees in various parts of Marx's own work, where there were only two classes of any importance, capitalists and workers. Thus, there are a whole range of other sorts of social positions located in the class structure which cannot be neatly packaged as either workers or capitalists. I've analyzed that in very specific kinds of ways that probably would be too tedious for me in this forum to go into the specific details, but I have dubbed these other kinds of class locations, like managers and professionals, I've called them contradictory locations within class relations, meaning that they are class positions which partake in certain respects of attributes of workers and in other respects of attributes of dominant classes like the capitalist class. They're not a kind of simple new class in their own right. They derive their attributes from their relationship to these two primary classes.
An example that might illuminate this for some of the audience is that in my own dissertation, I was looking at the question of physician proletarianization and how managed care might be a place in which doctors' work was becoming standardized and commodified and increasingly subdivided into other workers, kind of an industrialization of medical labor. And that would be an example of kind of the fulfillment of Marxian prophecy if there was, in fact, a process where these professionals and their kind of work was being turned into proletarian labor. Do you think that that is a general trend, that a lot of the intellectual jobs that people do, like for instance, computer programmers, which people thought was going to be one of these jobs that would never be automated, now seems to be at least being proletarianized in the developing world, if not automated as well?
Yeah, I think there's really two trends that operate simultaneously, and the exact balance between them varies over time. One trend is a trend of routinization, simplification, specialization, where positions, occupations, jobs, which at one time had a great deal of autonomy and required a great deal of self-direction and expertise, do become routinized. In the case of computer programmers, the original computer programmers were essentially software engineers. now that many packages exist, a great deal of computer programming is done in a highly routinized way, and in a way that I think is properly described as a job that's in the working class. That is, a job where a person has no autonomy, no control over their own work, is directly supervised and told what to do, and if they lose their job, they have no particular resources available and must look for another one. That is essentially what a proletarianized position means. On the other hand, technical change also creates new kinds of highly skilled jobs which have not yet been routinized and which have a great deal of autonomy, sometimes even power associated with them. And these new jobs grow at the same time that older jobs are being proletarianized in the way you described. Exactly how the balance between these two trends cashes out, sort of which is the predominant one, is extremely hard to know empirically. That is very difficult to get reliable data that would enable one to answer that question. But in any case, I think is best thought of as variable rather than some master trend in which it's always the case that the simplification and routinization processes are more important throughout history than the elaboration of new skills and the development of more complex jobs. Both things are going on.
Speaking with Eric Olenright, he's a professor of sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and one of the leading theorists of social class. I'm Dr. J, and this is Change Surfer Radio. I saw you recently speak at the U.S. Basic Income meeting in New York City, and you gave a wonderful exposition, which is available now on the web, about the relationship between basic income and the socialist project, which, I've been a socialist for the last 25 years or so, and the socialist project seems to be at a pretty low ebb internationally. But your talk was very inspiring because you said that there was always going to be a struggle between those who wanted to provide public goods that interfered with the commodification process of capital, and that basic income might be one of those kinds of public goods. So do you think that there is going to be a revival of socialism qua socialism, or are you looking for a next left which comes up with some different model but has some of the same, provides some of the same impediments to commodification and capitalist process?
Now, the term socialism, of course, is loaded with connotations that come from its historical use in various political contexts. So, for example, the fact that an authoritarian bureaucratic regime such as the Soviet Union called itself socialist has imbued that term with a particular set of meanings which many people find objectionable. Now, I myself thought that the Soviet Union was never socialist. It was never a society that organized its affairs along the principles that traditionally have been identified with socialism. But nevertheless, that connotation has been created by those historical realities. One of the things that means is that it may well be that the resurgence of socialist ideas and socialist movements in the future will go under some other name. The term socialist may have been sufficiently compromised by this historical experience of the 20th century that it may simply not be the case that socialist ideas will be called socialist. Nevertheless, I do think that the central principles, the central ideas of a socialist society, that is, of a society within which power and priorities are organized around social need, rather than the needs of capital, I think that movements with those values and those objectives are certainly likely to gain strength at some point in the future. I don't think capitalism will benignly continue without challenge, given the harms and devastations which capitalism creates. And thus, it's more a question of how we think through the principles and the ideas of that tradition than it is the specific label. I continue to use the term socialism. I think the first half of that word, social, is of crucial importance, and it conveys some of the central moral imperatives that the socialist tradition has tried to advance.
You are running a project called the Real Utopias Project, and it sounds like it's an effort to identify what some of those post-socialism, quasi-socialism projects might be that nonetheless embody these principles.
Yeah, the expression real utopia is a kind of oxymoron. Utopias are thought of as fantasies, whereas realists are the sorts of people that thumb their nose at fantasies and want to be pragmatic. The project is called Real Utopia because I am, and the people with whom I'm working on this project, want to affirm that tension, a tension between our deepest aspirations for social change, for human emancipation, the tension between those visions and aspirations, and the pragmatic requirements of real institutions that would be feasible and viable and reproducible over time. At the core of the Real Utopias project is the problem of social power and how to restore the centrality of the social over the economic in the world in which we live. There is, I think, a set of historic possibilities in which the power that determines our collective fate is shifted from the realm of the economy, where currently power is concentrated in many ways through large corporations, through the concentrations of capital, where power is shifted back to society. And that, I think, is at the very center of what socialism means. Just very briefly, I would distinguish three forms or ideals of society, of how you could organize a society, which I call capitalism, statism, and socialism. The Soviet Union, then, is the purest example of a statist society. The United States is about as good an example of a capitalist society as we can find. In a statist society, power is primarily organized through the state. In a capitalist society, the most fundamental and pervasive form of power is economic power, that is, power derived from people's control over economic resources. In a socialist society, power is rooted in society, in people's collective organization, in community, in their voluntary cooperation. And then the problem of constructing a socialist society, that is, a society within which that form of power is central, has to do with how do you link social power to economic power on the one hand and social power to state power on the other. Democracy is the term we use to describe a way of linking social power to state power. That is, a democracy is a form of governance in which state power is subordinated to the power of society, in principle. But we have more trouble thinking about how to subordinate economic power to social power. The main way that that has occurred in capitalist societies has been through labor movements. That's the central way in which people's collective organization has played a role in subordinating economic power to social power. But we have to think imaginatively of other ways that this can take place, and that is what I see as the central problem that the Real Utopias Project is grappling with, how to reaffirm the importance of social power and imagine, envision its dominance over economic power.
One of the central ideas that seems to have influenced a lot of different social thinkers out of the Marxian tradition is the notion that technology determines the conditions under which all other kinds of social change can occur and creates new opportunities for social change. I personally am very optimistic that things like automation and the information economy will allow new forms of democracy and new forms of anti-capitalist struggle to take place. Are you similarly optimistic or guardedly optimistic about that kind of technological determinism of new social change opportunities?
As long as the emphasis is on the word opportunities and potentials rather than prediction, I am optimistic. That is, I do think technical advance, the extraordinary advances in productivity on the one hand, and the more specific advances in communications technologies on the other, create new potentials. But those potentials are not necessarily realized because the structures of inequality, of power, of domination in the society can block the realization of those potentials. There is no guarantee whatsoever that simply because the potential for new ways of human flourishing and development have been created by technical change, that we will have the collective will or the organizational capacity to actually realize those potentials. And that's why I think the process is not a deterministic one, deterministic in the simple sense, that once you get an advanced technology, then you can predict what forms of social organization and liberation will occur. But rather, it's a historically contingent or indeterminate process that depends upon, on the one hand, accidents of history, things that happen that we can't predict at all, but also our collective efforts at forming organizations and associations to struggle for that realization.
One of the commonplace ideas in left analysis nowadays is that sometime in the early part of the 20th century, there was a crystallization of a tacit agreement through much struggle, but nonetheless it ended up as an agreement that workers would be able to organize and they would be able to be paid high wages and then be able to buy lots of things in a consumer economy, and that there would be certain kinds of social goods provided through the state in order to subsidize consumption, and that sometime around Reagan and Thatcher and the energy crisis of the 70s or something in the latter part of the 20th century changed, so that now there's this global pressure to get rid of the welfare state and to constrain opportunities for social provision. And some people think that was caused by globalization. Is that part of your worldview, that there's been this kind of cataclysmic change in the opportunity for social provision? And how does that constrain the notion of a socialist project?
I am extremely skeptical that globalization as such forces upon developed capitalist countries a miserly system of social provision, a destruction of the welfare state, a privatization of all of the public goods that had been established in the middle parts of the 20th century. I do not think that globalization forces countries in this direction. And indeed, if we look comparatively across the developed capitalist world, there are in Europe plenty of examples of countries whose welfare states have been very robust in the face of these globalization pressures, and especially in countries which in principle should be the most vulnerable to such globalization pressures. After all, a small country like Sweden, which depends entirely upon trade for its own prosperity, which is a much more open economy than the American economy has ever been, a small country like Sweden should be under terrific pressure to dismantle its welfare state, but it simply hasn't happened. It remains the case in Sweden that over 50% of the gross domestic product goes through the state for various forms of social provision. It has a large state sector of employment, and there's very little pressure within Sweden to dismantle it. Now, there's been some change, but those changes are caused by processes and dynamics that are really rather separate from the issue of globalization per se. I think globalization is an excuse for attacking the welfare state, but it's not actually the primary reason. These are political questions that have to do with the degree of social solidarity in a society, the extent to which people feel a sense of common fate and common community and common responsibility for fellow citizens. There's no reason whatsoever in the United States that the tax rates necessary to support generous redistributive programs, robust educational and training programs for disadvantaged groups, there's no reason why the tax rates in the United States couldn't be at the same levels as at Sweden, instead of being at roughly half the levels of Swedish tax rates. The reason we don't have such high levels of taxation is because the political coalitions which control the political processes in the United States are opposed to them, but not because the economic conditions as such prohibit this from happening.
One of the dynamics around globalization is also the kind of projection on the part of left analysts and left theorists that there will be a political globalization. And I've long been a supporter of world federalism and long hoped that the Socialist International might become more solid block of parties working more in unison. And you see some of that happening in the European Union, where you have a real democratic body in which they can work. Do you think that the next left has to jump up to that global level of organization to transcend some of the limitations of social democratic politics in one country? I mean, given what you just said, it doesn't seem like it's necessary.
I don't think it's necessary for purposes of having a progressive and more egalitarian form of social provision within countries. That is, I don't think a necessary condition for progressive politics domestically is the construction of a supranational state. Now, that doesn't imply that I don't think that a strengthening of the United Nations, certainly a strengthening of European institutions, and the development of more transnational democratic organizations wouldn't be a good thing. The problem under existing circumstances is that such transnational organizations would almost certainly be pawns of powerful capitalist interests and would not be very democratically accountable. Now, that still might mean that it's better to have them than not have them, but I think the prospects in any immediate future for a global federalism that would have a democratic character and be accountable to the people as opposed to accountable to elites seems pretty remote. And in any case, I don't think it's a necessary condition for the development of more egalitarian and progressive forms of social provision within countries.
This will have to be one of the last questions, I guess, but given what you just said, are you a theorist who thinks that the more decentralized a political unit is, the more likely it will be accountable to actual social and democratic processes, and that a global state would be less feasibly accountable to those kind of processes and more accountable to capital? Or do you think that it's the same problem all the way up in the level of hierarchy?
In my book, which I wrote with Archon Fung, called Deepening Democracy, we reject the contrast between centralized and decentralized democratic or political institutions and argue for a need to strengthen both central and decentralized forms of governance, that a vibrant local democracy depends upon what we call recombinant decentralization, that is, central institutions that are able to redistribute resources across the decentralized units and to provide a context where the learning capacity of decentralized units of action of democracy are strengthened. So I think what we need is a rethinking of how to link centralized and decentralized political activities rather than the more anarchistic vision of simply fracturing the state downwards towards fragmented, autonomous, decentralized units.
I want to really thank you for joining us. And is Approaches to Class Analysis out?
It's in press and should be out sometime this summer.
Excellent. And what are you working on after that?
I'm writing a book called Envisioning Real Utopias, which will be the sort of overarching framework for the Real Utopias project. That I should have done by sometime in the fall, I suspect.
Excellent. Well, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
I've been speaking with Eric Olenright. He's a professor of sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and a leading theorist of social class. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts with me, Dr. J, you can contact me at jhughes@changesurfer.com. That's jhughes@changesurfer.com. Or you can read my Change Surfing columns at betterhumans.com or check out the collaborative Cyborg Democracy blog I participate in at cyborgdemocracy.net. Or you can read my new book, Citizen Cyborg. For more details about Citizen Cyborg, visit cyborgdemocracy.net. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3, thanks to the AInfos radio project. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.